Today is Wednesday, December 30th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, conditions worsen for refugees at the Ethiopian-Sudan border.
They have been told that they are no longer allowed to stay in the city. They're not legally in Sudan as residents. They're there as refugees.
Also ahead, Britain approves use of second COVID-19 vaccine.
Safety was paramount throughout this process, and that the approval had been reached following a thorough and scientifically rigorous review of all the evidence of safety.
Plus, a newly elected member of the U.S. Congress has died of COVID-19. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Sudan, and conditions are worsening for refugees on the Ethiopian-Sudan border. More displaced people are arriving daily to swell the population of overcrowded camps. For more, I spoke with VOA's Heather Murdock, who recently visited the region.
Aid workers are working hard to accommodate the people that are coming into camps from across the border, and also the border camps, the ones that are near the border, have, for the most part, the people have been moved into the main camp, Umrakuba. It's quite crowded as of now, so conditions there, I wouldn't want to say that they're not working to make them better, but the conditions are very harsh. I mean, it's really hard to get enough water to wash and cook, and people are struggling to have shelter. I spoke to some refugees today that were sheltering in a city near the border, and they have been told that they are no longer allowed to stay in the city. They're not legally in Sudan as residents. They're there as refugees. So they were told that in the next couple of days, they're going to be moved into yet another camp. And UNICEF has recently said that they're expecting another large influx of people to be coming across the border. So it's a constantly changing situation, but I cannot overstate how difficult it is day to day for the people living there, especially the most vulnerable people trying to get medicine or care for special needs children. It's nearly impossible.
What is the strain like for the local population?
Local people that I've spoke to at the beginning were very welcoming and going out of their way to try to bring food and shelter to people coming across the border. And it's not to say that people have been hostile. I haven't seen any of that. But I've seen a very real fear from people in local communities. They say that rents have already gone up. Prices of food have already skyrocketed. It's a poor country in general, and it's a very poor part of one of the poorest countries on earth to begin with. The local people are genuinely scared that if the refugee crisis continues and continues to worsen, that their situation will become unlivable as well.
What about issues of security?
There is an ongoing issue of border security. The area that a lot of people are coming from Ethiopia into Sudan, it's a heavily militarized area where Sudan, Ethiopia, and Eritrea all have a border within sight of each other and military bases in this area. And there has been some cross-border skirmishes. There's also been diplomacy on a high level trying to keep this area secure. I've been told that while when things are quiet, it's always an issue to worry about security in that area, because even high-level talks might not necessarily pan out on the ground. These are disputes over land, and at a time where resources are so slim for so many people in the area, a lot of local people are afraid that regardless of negotiations in the country's capitals, there still might be considerable security issues ongoing.
What challenges do aid agencies face in trying to make a difference in the lives of these refugees?
Well, I think the biggest challenge is access to the Tigray region. There are so many people displaced and homeless in the Tigray region itself that it's impossible to even count, because there's very little access for aid organizations and journalists, not just people displaced from the current conflict, but Eritrean people that had made their home as refugees in Ethiopia. The aid organizations on the ground in Sudan also face, besides trying to get enough just basic resources, money, food, water, shelters, it's also very remote areas. It's hard to get to. It's hard to get anything there to, like, there's not electricity wires going there. There's not internet there. There's not, for the most part, mobile phone service. The roads themselves are hard to get through. The closest camp to the nearest city is an hour and a half through a remote desert area. The ones closer to the border are something more like 5 to 7 hours nearest to the closest city in Sudan. So they're just difficult to get resources to the camps, and the Tigray region is still largely cut off.
Any special consideration for children who are, of course, the most vulnerable in conditions like this?
UNICEF, the UN Children's Agency, has recently raised the alarm, saying about 20% of the people coming across are children, and that this should be a real consideration, and a lot of extra help is needed for the children. And of course, aid organizations do make special considerations for children trying to bring food and make safe places for them to play and set up schools as much as they can. You see, you know, houses or shelters built that are meant entirely to educate kids as much as possible. As with particularly a refugee situation that was so swift and so violent and in such a area that needs resources already, there's just not nearly enough to take care of children, especially ones that have special needs or illnesses.
That's VOA's Heather Murdock speaking with me from Istanbul. U.S. Representative-elect Luke Letlow of Louisiana died on Tuesday of COVID-19, his campaign said. Emma McCarthy of Reuters reports.
U.S. Representative-elect Luke Letlow of Louisiana died on Tuesday of COVID-19, his campaign said. The 41-year-old announced on December 18 that he had tested positive for coronavirus and passed away in a hospital in Shreveport, Louisiana. Letlow, a Republican, won a runoff election on December 5 for the 5th District seat, which represents northeast and central Louisiana, and was due to be sworn in on Sunday. He is survived by his wife and two children. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards and U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi were among those that expressed their sorrow and paid tribute to Letlow.
That's Emma McCarthy of Reuters. President-elect Joe Biden says the Trump administration's COVID-19 vaccine rollout is lagging and that the nation needs to get ready for more hard times. AP Washington correspondent Sergei Magani reports.
We need to steel our spines for what's ahead.
Biden says the coming weeks and months will be tough.
Maybe the toughest during this entire pandemic.
With experts warning holiday travel and gatherings could lead to another spike in virus cases. Biden says there is hope with vaccine development, but he says Trump administration efforts to get Americans vaccinated have fallen far behind. The CDC says just about 2 million people have received a shot. Biden says at that rate,
it's going to take years, not months, to vaccinate the American people.
President Trump brushed off the critique, tweeting, it's up to states to distribute the vaccines once they arrive at designated areas. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Colorado's governor says contact tracing is underway to determine if more than one person in the state has the COVID-19 variant that's been previously detected in the United Kingdom. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
The COVID-19 variant was confirmed in a young man in his 20s who's now in isolation in Elbert County, southeast of Denver. The county health director, quoted by Colorado Politics, says there is a second suspected case, another person who works in the county but doesn't live there, leading to concerns that the variant's already being spread throughout the state. Colorado public health officials are doing contact tracing and sharing information with the Federal Centers for Disease Control. One virus expert says the variant may have come into Colorado from travelers from Britain in November or December. I'm Jackie Quinn.
The UK has approved its second COVID-19 vaccine. The go-ahead for the Oxford University AstraZeneca shot comes as the UK battles a fast-spreading new variant of the coronavirus. For more, VOA's Jesse Patenkin spoke to journalist Henry Ridgewell in London.
Yes, so this approval had been widely anticipated. The British regulator, the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, gave a press conference this morning where they said that, again, safety was paramount throughout this process and that the approval had been reached following a thorough and scientifically rigorous review of all the evidence of safety and of the quality and effectiveness of the vaccine from AstraZeneca and Oxford University. And they've given the approval. The British government says the orders are in place. Several million doses have already been produced, and they expect to be able to start rolling out mass vaccinations around January the 4th, so in a few days' time.
And let's look at the two different vaccines. What are some of the differences between these two vaccines?
So the origin of the two vaccines is different. The way they need to be stored is different. The AstraZeneca vaccine only needs to be stored at fridge temperatures, whereas the Pfizer vaccine needs to be stored at minus 70. And the AstraZeneca vaccine is also much cheaper to mass produce. It's going to cost around $3 or $4 per dose compared to around $20 for the Pfizer vaccine.
Looking at the dosage of this AstraZeneca vaccine, there's a bit of maybe uncertainty about the size of the dose and how many doses should be taken and what effectiveness that has. Can you go into that issue a bit?
Yes. So when the trials were taking place, and these trials have been underway, let's not forget, since April, so shortly after the pandemic swept the globe, the different doses have been given of the vaccine to participants in the trials. Now, by accident, during that trial process by AstraZeneca, some of the participants, a small number, were given a half dose as their initial first dose and then a full dose for the second dose. That actually showed a greater effectiveness against the disease than those who were given two full doses. Those who were given a half dose initially had around 90% immunity to the disease rather than 70% for the rest of the participants. That investigation into whether a half initial dose is more effective is still ongoing, and the scientists will need more data to reach that conclusion. What's happened now with Britain's approval is that the regulator has looked at the regular dosing, so two full doses between 4 and 12 weeks apart. They have given their approval to that dosing regime, and that is the basis upon which the British government will launch their mass vaccination program using the AstraZeneca vaccine. But that's not to say that further down the line, when more evidence becomes available, that the regime might change slightly and we might go back to using a half dose and then a full dose if that proves to be more effective.
There's, of course, this new variant of COVID-19 spreading in the world, but in particular in the UK. Any word on whether either of these vaccines are effective against that?
That is yet to be proven in practice, but the scientists say that there is no indication that the new mutant variation of the virus will be resistant to the vaccine. So they say that both the Pfizer and the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine should be effective against this new variant. And it's worth just underlining that how welcome this news is today of the AstraZeneca vaccine here in Britain, when we've had record numbers of infections, record numbers of hospitalizations over the past 24 hours. It really is quite a bleak outlook. Warnings of hospitals being overwhelmed, of the return of a full national lockdown, possibly within the next few days.
That's my colleague Jason Patinkin speaking with VOA's Henry Ridgewell in London. This is the Voice of America. A Yemeni health official says the explosion that hit the airport in the southern city of Aden as a government plane landed there has killed at least 16 people. The blast struck the airport building shortly after the Yemeni airplane carrying the newly formed cabinet landed on Wednesday. Members of the government delegation were disembarking as the blast shook the grounds. No one on the government plane was hurt. The deputy head of Aden's health office says that at least 60 people were wounded in the explosion. A landslide in a remote region of Papua New Guinea has buried 15 people, including 3 children, who are all feared dead, a government spokesman said Wednesday. The people were asleep in a house near a mine that they had been panning for gold when the landslide buried the building in the Gurilala district of the country's central province early Monday. Thailand imposed a ban on Wednesday on large gatherings and events across the country in an effort to contain its worst coronavirus outbreak yet over the New Year holiday, with active cases in over half of its provinces. Authorities have asked the public to avoid travel and have imposed tighter control measures in areas, including entertainment businesses. The European Union's top officials have formally signed a post-Brexit trade deal with the United Kingdom as lawmakers in London get set to vote on the agreement. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen and European Council President Charles Michel put pen to paper on Wednesday morning during a brief signing ceremony in Brussels. The documents were being flown across the Channel to London for British Prime Minister Boris Johnson to sign them later. This is the Voice of America.
This is Science in a Minute.
Humankind has used a variety of devices to keep track of and measure time. The U.S. National Institute for Standards and Technology says its atomic clock in Boulder, Colorado, is so accurate that it only varies by 0.03 nanoseconds per day, or about 1 second in 100 million years. Physicists at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology say they have designed a new type of atomic clock that's not only more accurate, but could also help detect physics phenomena such as dark matter and gravitational waves. Unlike the atomic clocks of today, which measure the oscillations of random atoms, the new MIT clock gauges atoms that have become quantumly entangled. The website sciencedaily.com defines that as atoms that have lost their individuality and synced up with each other. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Courts in Malawi have started imposing stiffer penalties on perpetrators of rape and sexual abuse. The move is seen as a response to calls for rights activists to end lenient sentences for sexual offenses. As Lamek Messina reports from Blantyre, activists say more needs to be done.
Statistics from the Malawi Police Service show that recorded cases of rape in the country have more than doubled since 2018. Figures from the National Statistics Office show that for the last 3 months of this year alone, sexual abuse cases have been 35% higher than the same period last year. Rights campaigners blame the rise on lenient penalties given to the perpetrators. Now, local media are noting a sudden trend toward longer prison terms for those convicted of rape and sexual abuse. They say the average sentence has jumped from 10 years to 20, with some perpetrators getting life imprisonment. For example, a high court in Lilongwe last week sentenced a 30-year-old man to life imprisonment for raping a 10-year-old girl and infecting her with HIV. This came a week after a court in Blantyre sentenced a 42-year-old man to 20 years in jail for raping his stepdaughter. She, too, was infected with HIV. Barbara Banda is head of Gender Coordination Network, an NGO which has been holding protests against rising cases of gender-based violence.
We are happy that we have gotten to this level where we can see the biggest punishment that can be given by the court. But what is worrying is that we continue to see the cases surface every day, which means that these sentences, they are not a complete deterrent avenues of addressing increased GBV and defilement.
Banda says the focus on should be changing mindsets that can cause sexual abuses. Some Malawians falsely believe that having sex with a minor can cure HIV or will somehow bring great wealth. Justice Zwone Ntaba is a judge at the High Court of Malawi and the National Program Coordinator for the Women Judges Association of Malawi, or WOJAM. WOJAM has partnered with other organizations to sponsor traveling courts so people can see justice being carried out with their own eyes. She believes this is important to deterring sexual crimes.
Apart from the stiff sentence, the biggest issue for us in terms of crime reduction is that ensuring that justice is seen when the crime is done, because that is what actually changes people's mindset. It's not necessarily just the stiff punishment. It's the aspect of seeing a person who's committed a crime go through the system and get convicted, and that will bring that mindset change.
Justice Ntaba says she also thinks rising cases of sexual abuse can also be reduced by investing in crime prevention measures. Malawi's Minister of Gender says it has partnered with various organizations, including Malawi Police Service, in a national awareness campaign against sexual abuse and gender-based violence. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
You are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Iran Energy Minister Reza Ardakhanian visited Baghdad Tuesday to discuss supply cuts of Iranian natural gas that have forced Iraq to cut back on electricity supply to 4 hours a day in most places. Tehran maintains that Baghdad owes it more than $5 billion in unpaid fees for both gas and electricity. VOA's Edward Iranian reports from Cairo.
Iraqi state TV announced Tuesday the country is suffering from a major electricity crisis following the drastic reduction of natural gas supplies by Iran from 50 million to 5 million cubic meters. Tehran says Baghdad must pay at least several billion dollars of an estimated $5 billion debt it owes Tehran for natural gas and electricity. Iranian Energy Minister Reza Ardakhanian met top Iraqi officials, including Electricity Minister Majid Hantush and Central Bank Governor Mustafa Ghalib, during Ardakhanian's visit to Baghdad Tuesday to discuss the crisis. Iranian Revolutionary Guard Commander Mustafa Kaani reportedly also met with Tehran Shiite militia allies in Baghdad during the past several days. The visits come amid tensions between Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa Kazemi and pro-Iranian Shiite militia commanders, including Qais al-Khazali, leader of the Asahab Ahl al-Haq militia, over the arrest of militia members accused of firing rockets at the U.S. Embassy compound in Baghdad. Iranian government spokesman Ali Rabiei said in a press conference Tuesday in Tehran that Iran has no ties to the militias firing rockets at the embassy and that Washington knows that many different groups in Iraq want to end its occupation of the country. He accused the U.S. of provoking tensions in the region. The spokesman says Washington is responsible for tensions in the Gulf, adding it must stop what he called its cross-border intervention and adventurism in the region. Next week marks the first anniversary of a U.S. drone strike that killed top Iranian military commander General Qasem Soleimani as his convoy left Baghdad airport. Some Iranian leaders and their Iraqi militia allies have vowed to avenge Soleimani's death. Former Iranian President Abul Hassan Bani Sadr tells VOA the situation in Iraq is chaotic and the Iraqi government is both financially bankrupt and politically paralyzed. For these reasons, he says, he doubts Iran is trying to topple the government of Prime Minister Kazemi. He says toppling the regime only makes sense when there is a functioning government, but the state is paralyzed and the government does not function. Iraq, he adds, is now struggling to maintain both an internal equilibrium between Sunnis, Shiites, and Kurds, and an external equilibrium between Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. Bani Sadr adds that he doesn't think Iran will react on the one-year anniversary of the death of General Soleimani because it is not militarily strong enough. Most Iranian government spokesmen, he says, are calling for non-military revenge. Acting U.S. Defense Secretary Christopher Miller said in November that U.S. forces inside Iraq would be drawn down to approximately 2,500 personnel by January 2021. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Ophelia Yabaro, and our colleague, Jason Patenkin, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I'm Chinedu from Washington. Thank you for listening, and have a great evening.